Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling and glad to be back with you after about 10 days off. Coming up on today's episode, we'll talk with Bruce Milton, an associate at Lee and Associates. Nearly 40 years of commercial real estate experience, and we'll talk to him about the current state of retail real estate. Our conversation runs the gamut. We'll talk about things that retailers are looking at as far as where they open up new stores. We'll also talk about how cities and zoning impacts the development and reuse, in some cases, of retail real estate. So an interesting conversation with Bruce. We'll also chat briefly about REI in our Looking Ahead segment, and in news, it's pet retail as Petco has their first earnings call as a public company, or at least as this iteration of a public company since they had the IPO in January. First of all, quick reminder that you can like us or rate us or subscribe to us, however you access us. It came to our attention earlier this week that there were some issues on Google Podcasts. We're now back on that platform, but we're on every other platform you can think of: Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, and of course, Apple Podcasts as well. Check us out on social media in addition at Retail Podcast. I just loaded some pictures up on Instagram from a great rural grocery store in Guymon, Oklahoma, the Panhandle of Oklahoma, where I was on business this week. That grocery store, absolutely killing it. One of the most beautiful grocery stores I've been in throughout the course of the last few years. Carter's was the name. It's been open less than a year, so certainly give that a look. Well, as I mentioned, we'd be remiss if we didn't lead the show with Petco's earnings call this week. And we've been looking forward to this call after, as I mentioned, the IPO for Petco in January. Dollar General and Ollie's also, by the way, released earnings on Thursday of this past week. Dollar General with a slight miss, Ollie's with a 14% beat, but it is all about the state of pet retail in our news segment this week, and Petco is showing much of the same strength we've seen from Chewy during the pandemic. We talked before about Petco's rebrand efforts and their endeavor to kind of bridge the gap between, at least in the pet space, a Whole Foods-like retailer and a Kroger-like retailer. In the mind of pet product buyers, they're pushing a lot towards increased use of naturals and elimination of artificial ingredients in the products they sell, and there were a lot of platitudes about those things on the earnings call. Now, as far as that's concerned, I'm not one to speak to maybe how good their selection is in terms of the natural and organic pet food, because it looks pretty similar to some of the other stores, but again, it's all in the brand for Petco. And it seems to be working to this point with pet buyers. As far as their fourth quarter earnings were concerned, revenue was up 16% as a company. Comp sales were up 17%, those comp store sales for the quarter. Digital sales likewise saw a boost, 90% growth there. And yes, digital sales are folded in to comp store sales since so many of those digital sales are touching the stores. Now, this is promising for Petco. And honestly, when you look at their digital sales, that's a good sign that they're holding their own in e-commerce versus Chewy. In any case, these numbers were above what had been previously seen for their 2020 fiscal year during their first three quarters, and as a result, brought both revenue and comp sales growth to 11% for the full 2020 year over 2019. Adjusted earnings per share for the fourth quarter as a consequence came in at 17 cents to the positive. This is after some losses in previous quarters. Now, I should mention that they did show a loss on a GAAP basis, but this loss primarily due to the paying off of debt as a result of their IPO. We'll talk about how that impacted interest here in a second. Growth was seen for them in both ticket and transactions. So again, it's not just ticket size going up. It's not pet customers stocking up all at once. The latter, the transactions part, that's a beneficiary of the nearly 1 million new customers acquired in the quarter. That's on top of the nearly 1 million customers they added in the third quarter. And they noted that their customer acquisition cost is either the lowest or one of the lowest in the industry during the analyst Q&A based on the numbers that they've got. More specifically, they said they feel as though mom-and-pop operators cannot compete with what their CFO, Mike Nuzzo, called a customer acquisition machine, and I quote that. So they're very confident in their ability to pick up customers. We've seen that from nearly 2 million new customers over the past couple of quarters. Inventory, meanwhile, was up over 12% from a year ago. And of course, when sales are going up, inventory is going to naturally go up. We've talked about inventory levels for many retailers of late. Everyone's handling the pandemic slightly differently as far as inventories are concerned. Apparel retailers, usually with less inventory in stock. We discussed Big Lots in the last show, having an inordinate amount of inventory in transit on its way to distribution centers. We've talked about Walmart basically trying to hoard inventory to ensure in stocks. For Petco, though, inventory is about scaling up with a number of high margin items and the number of these high margin items that they've got in stock because they're running customer specific promotions surrounding these high margin items. Again, with their loyalty programs and with a lot of the consumer data that they've got that every other retailer certainly has, they're deciding to kind of pivot somewhat from mass discounts and they're instead running loyalty specific promotions. And these promotions are designed to push their highest spending customers, those customers that are spending on average 40% more than the typical pet consumer, towards those high margin products. To this point, leadership said the plan is working, ergo, more inventory in those high margin areas. One other interesting number, specifically from the call, and that has to do with their debt. Their total debt was reduced by 49% by using their IPO proceeds. Because it took effect midway through the quarter as they were paying off their debt from the IPO proceeds, and in fact, a lot of their debt restructuring had taken place in March after the quarter ended, they did put a dent in interest expense by the tune of over $10 million in that fourth quarter. Prior to this quarter, interest expense had been in the neighborhood of $60 million per quarter. So going forward, you'd think, well, we can imagine a benefit in the neighborhood of about $30 million per quarter from this if they paid down half of their debt. But that's not all. They were able to restructure a lot of that debt. As a result, the company said it's probably going to have a larger impact than just shaving off their interest expense by half. They project just $90 million of interest expense during 2021. Now, $90 million for some retailers might seem like a lot, but that number was around $217 million during this past year, and even more than that during 2019. So a good sign there for Petco, and that means more liquidity, which in turn means, in theory, more CapEx for some of their initiatives. Their integrated pet hospital, speaking of initiatives, they opened over 40 veterinary clinics during 2021. They reported that is also doing pretty well. Surgery numbers were up, and that resulted in an increase in income for this division. Continued acceleration, at least so far, in terms of use of those veterinary clinics, use of the surgery centers. So far, I mentioned quarter one of 2021. Now, of course, this being the fourth quarter earnings call, there were a lot of forward-looking statements and leadership, most notably Ron Coughlin, their CEO, said that an influx of pet adoptions during the pandemic has resulted in what the company is terming an annuity. And we've talked about pet adoptions being fairly high during the pandemic. This was a looking ahead segment we had all the way back in mid-2020. But for Petco, they're looking at it as basically regenerating customers for the next 10 to 20 years as these adoptions are taking place. Essentially, they see it as the guarantee of spending in the pet space for many years to come as a result of these pet adoptions. And although clearly Petco is in a battle with other similar stores for share of wallet, whether that be Pet Supplies Plus, whether that be PetSmart, what have you, they feel as though they're competing favorably with retailers and spending outlets outside of the pet forum as a whole in terms of staking pets to an increasing overall share of wallet. And they said basically, once they get people in the habit of spending money on their pets, that continues during the course of the life of the pet. And speaking to pet-specific share of wallet, by the way, moving back to that specific chunk there, Their vital care initiative, they said, is helping dramatically in this regard. They now have 50,000 members in the program, which launched in October of last year. 19% of the 50,000 members in the program are new to buying food at Petco, and 30% are new to services with Petco. Just to provide you a little bit of an overview, this is a membership program that it gives checkups, vaccinations, grooming, discounts. It's kind of a one-stop shop. So it's different than their loyalty program, but it's actually a program designed for basically maintenance and upkeep of your pet. And part of this initiative was to drive crossover traffic as much as possible, because in some of the data that they had, they found that their customers have the tendency sometimes to be siloed. I mentioned 19% of the customers that are in this program weren't buying food at Petco for their pets prior to enrollment in this program. But we see customers siloed off in other ways. For example, some customers were using veterinary services or grooming services, but not buying other merchandise. Some customers were buying maybe food, but not other merchandise, and they weren't using the grooming services. So they're trying to get customers to kind of bridge those gaps and see Petco more as a one-stop shop for their pets, kind of remove those silos among their customers, because they said it's interesting as they look at the numbers that they've accumulated. It's very clear that some customers only go to Petco for one or two things. They want customers to go to Petco for all things. Given the success of this program so far, given the success of some of their other programs so far that are incentivizing, again, purchase of those high-margin products that might be a little bit outside of the customer's wheelhouse or customer's typical wheelhouse with Petco, they feel as though they can break down those silos and get customers to see Petco for the whole rather than just one or two particular goods. And to that point, I thought it was interesting because they talked a little bit on the call about marketing. You know, if let's say you're a Kroger customer and you're part of their loyalty program, you're going to get coupons for essentially things that are either what you bought before at Kroger or items similar to what you've bought before. Kroger's not really pushing you coupons too much, at least, to other categories where you're not currently spending money in. Petco is kind of taking the opposite approach. They're saying, hey, you come to us for food, why not buy this other thing? If you come to us for cat food, why not buy this cat tree, for example, or something similar to that? So I thought that was very interesting as they talked about their marketing strategy on the call. Now, they did release 2021 guidance as well during the Q4 call. They expect revenue in the $5.25 to $5.35 billion range. That would be a significant bump over their approximately $4.9 billion this year. Meanwhile, adjusted earnings per share is expected to be up as well over 2020. Came in at 28 cents for the entire 2020 year. They expect it to be in the 63 to 66 cent range for the full year 2021. And one final thing to look for regarding Petco, and I think this crosses over to the entire pet retailing industry as a whole, is fresh pet food for dogs. Their CEO Coughlin said on the call, the fresh category is roughly about $650 million today, projected to be about $2 billion by 2024. And as a result, Petco specifically is seeking to double their footprint of not only fresh, but all food for dogs during 2021. Part of the reason they want to push customers into the fresh category is because although it may increase those electric costs incrementally, you need that space for fridges, freezers, that type of thing. Customers that buy fresh dog food make twice as frequent trips, giving them the chance, of course, to add to basket on those trips. And that's something that they are, again, seeing in the data. If customers are buying fresh pet food, they're coming to Petco twice as often, and they're not just buying that fresh pet food when they come to Petco. They're buying other things each time they make that trip. So a positive sign, certainly, for Petco on that front. If they can increase spending, now there may be problems here in increasing the shelf space devoted to fresh pet food, because there's been noted supply chain issues on the front of fresh, especially fresh dog food. And if you go by these displays, whether it be in a grocery store, whether it be in a Walmart, whether it be in a pet store, sometimes it's tough to find the fresh pet food in stock. So it's not only an onus on these companies, Petco included, to simply carry more of it and devote more shelf space to it, it's going to be an onus on everything that's upstream to ensure that supply and demand are in sync somewhat, because right now demand outstripping supply in many cases, and if eventually that supply catches up, could mean very big things for not only Petco, but all retailers that sell fresh pet food. So, interesting things to keep an eye out for during 2021, the calendar year, as far as pet retail is concerned. Now, coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Bruce Milton, an associate at Lee & Associates. We're going to talk about the current state of retail real estate. And again, we'll talk about a great many things during this interview. Stay tuned. Now, 2 weeks ago on the show, we talked to the former CEO of Sephora USA about current trends and development in the retail mall space. Today, we're going to kind of zoom out somewhat to discuss the overall retail real estate landscape as a whole, including not just malls, but neighborhood centers and other developments. And joining us to discuss the current macro level state of retail real estate is Bruce Milton, an associate of Lee & Associates. He has over 30 years of commercial real estate experience and has worked with just about everyone from Walmart to Safeway, from tenants to landlords to developers. Bruce, thank you so much for joining the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Trent.
First, I gave a really brief introduction about your background there, but I was wondering if you might share a bit more about your personal background in commercial and retail real estate and also Lee & Associates' background as well.
Sure, you bet. Briefly, Lee & Associates is a national and international company. We have offices from California to New York. We are a unique organization in that the company and all the offices are owned by the brokers and agents. They are the partners. So I thought I'd just mention that, but we're in the US, Canada. We extend influence into Europe. And it's a company that started in 1979 by Bill Lee and is going strong and growing, as a matter of fact. My background in retail real estate extends actually close to 40 years, and I've worked on many different kinds of projects, from small strip centers to grocery anchored to mixed use projects, and worked in and around the malls as well, and small regional tenants to some of the nationals. I specialize in retail real estate during my tenure in real estate.
And I know that a lot of the business that you've done particularly is in the Southwest, but just looking at the retail real estate landscape as a whole in 2021, especially through the lens at Lee & Associates there, where are their strengths occupancy-wise, and likewise, where are we seeing weaknesses in terms of the types of centers that are filling, in terms of the types of centers that are having trouble backfilling?
So I'll briefly tell you that the darling of commercial real estate and retail real estate are the grocery anchored shopping centers. And they will always remain an integral part of the neighborhoods and trade areas because everybody gathers around and tenants gather around the grocery store anchors. However, when we're talking about very small tenants, there's been a tremendous amount of fallout, and it, of course, started to occur rapidly in 2020 and is continuing on because many small mom and pop retailers don't have the finances, the financial fortitude to go very long with a downturn in their business. So we're seeing a lot of fallout there. Conversely, we're seeing fallout with the biggest properties in the country. And these are the regional malls that have really started to have trouble going back into 2017, 2018. The Pittsburgh Mills Mall closed in 2018, and they took a $120 million loss in the sale of that. But there's some interesting stories. The Cary Town Center in North Carolina, for example, was purchased this year by a video company. Fortnite might be familiar to some, and Fortnite is turning that into their corporate campus. So they bought it right, but it was still a loss someplace for a financier or a commercial backed mortgage. However, the use changed completely. There is a very interesting issue with the Paradise Valley Mall in Phoenix, Arizona. That's a 40-year-old mall. It's about ready to go into a mixed-use project, and that's over 1.2 million square feet. And instead of losing the property, they're completely reinventing the property. And we can get into some more of those details when we talk about the future of retail. A number of these malls in Florida, Texas, some others are taking huge losses because the parties are unable to pay. So they're either repossessed, foreclosed, or sold in lieu of foreclosure. One of the statistics that I recall is that nationally, the malls in 2020 were collecting about 20% of their normal revenue. In other words, the drop-off in rental revenue for the medium-size and big malls was only 20% of what they would normally collect in a regular year. So you can see that if you have a $200 million mortgage and you're collecting enough revenue to make your payments on just a small portion of that, that can't be sustained very long. So we're going to see a lot of change, especially with these big, huge properties like that. And predominantly what I'm seeing, because I study this, is that we're seeing a lot of mall developers and mall owners reinventing those malls into mixed-use projects that have a combination of other uses, since they've lost some of the traditional medium-sized retailers and some of the biggest retailers for that matter. So I think we have problems in the mom-and-pop size. We have problems in the biggest size. And in the middle, it's kind of a mixed bag. And as I said, the grocery anchored shopping centers are really still the darling of retail real estate.
Let's talk briefly about those darlings, because as you mentioned, it's not the anchors that are moving out of them. Oftentimes it's the smaller mom and pop shops that are having to shut down. And in the case of a mall, you mentioned someone along the line is taking a loss, but a lot of them are getting converted, whether they be to corporate campuses or so forth. Can't really do that with those mom and pop spaces in the grocery anchored center. So what are you seeing some of these landlords try to do in terms of backfilling those former mom and pop spaces in what has become really ideal real estate out there in these grocery anchored centers?
Yes, your comment is correct. These are ideal centers, ideal locations. And in many cases, we're seeing as much as 25, 30% of these centers, maybe even more in the future, backfilling or converting retail space to non-retail type uses, i.e. small pharmacies, dental, medical. People might think that salons are retail, but that as well. So we're seeing these non-retail type uses. Many of these small restaurant franchises are out of business or couldn't hold on, so they're out. And we have companies coming in that are small, innovative coffee companies. Talk to some people that prepackage foods so that you really go there. You don't go there to eat. You go there and pick up your meal and take it home. But they need a commissary or a kitchen. So there's a second generation use of former food and small restaurant spaces. But the medical coming in, medical, dental, and those kinds of services is really helping a lot of these retail, medium-sized retail centers across the country, you know, to stay afloat and keep addressing their costs.
You mentioned a little while ago as well the mixed-use centers, and that's certainly become a hot topic surrounding real estate throughout the country, not only with REITs, but also other smaller developers. What are you seeing as far as trends in this mixed-use space where you've got a mix of retail and in some cases even multifamily housing?
Well, that's very interesting. There's one case study. Park Central Mall in Central Phoenix had a vision 15, 18 years ago to convert its big box space, JCPenney and Sears and some of these other boxes, into something else. And the reason they lost those tenants a long time ago is because of the changing demographic. People start to move out further and further from the hub of cities into the suburbs, where it's either more affordable or the lifestyle is different. There's less asphalt, that sort of thing. So Park Central Mall converted some of their box space into creative office space and leased big chunks of it. They also brought in a university that has a medical school in it. Well, how great of a use. The bones and box are still there, and a university comes in and takes it. So we're seeing with some of the big box users that have gone out, like Sears, Penny, Macy's is on its ear, some of those are going away and being backfilled in these big shopping centers, big regionals with office or with grocery, as a matter of fact, as well as the big ones. The Targets of the world are doing well. Kohl's, Ross, those types of stores are coming in and taking chunks of this space, which today is a little more affordable for them than the malls of yesteryear that charged, you know, top dollar. So we're seeing a lot of that. There's some innovative ideas where mall developers and shopping centers are also allowing self-storage development on the property, even hotels. So there's other different kinds of uses that are available. It's a matter of identifying them, who's looking, what your demographic needs, what your population is looking for. Trent, there's a key issue here that is going to be faced across the country, and that is the municipalities need to address zoning for a lot of these malls to allow these different kinds of uses. So if you go to a shopping center or you go to a mall, they don't necessarily allow self-storage there, for example. So you have to go back and address your zoning issues. So we talk about mixed-use conversions in centers or large centers, lifestyles, malls, but the municipalities need to be behind it to help save those properties and therefore their tax revenue.
I mentioned at the beginning that you were involved in so many different facets of the real estate process throughout the last 30 plus almost 40 years. And you mentioned zoning there. I think that's interesting. And I know we're not the zoning focus podcast necessarily, but it does matter, especially to retail and retail real estate holders. From the perspective of someone working behind the scenes, if we peel back the curtain a little bit, what can that zoning process or rezoning process look like as you begin to redevelop some of these retail real estate locations?
I think there's a couple of things. Cities are always concerned about the aesthetics from the outside or the view or that sort of thing. So when it comes to self-storage, it isn't necessarily as beautiful as the front of a Neiman Marcus or a Nordstrom's department store. So they have to, I guess, reduce some of their scrutiny, some of their details in terms of the aesthetics when you have an alternate use move in. Conversely, you have a grocery store or a Walmart, for example, a super Walmart, they'll have 5,000 people a week in something like that. So you have to observe traffic patterns and these types of things. Luckily, these mall properties, many of them are 40, 50, 100 acres, and they're these huge gaping holes in the middle of demographic populations that have ample room to tolerate parking needs. Sometimes, even if they were built 30, 40 years ago, they have still worked on all the traffic engineering issues. But the cities and municipalities need to ease up and cooperate a lot with the medium and large property owners and developers.
You talked a little bit about the evaluate potential new sites and locations on behalf of retailers and others. And we know certain retailers like Dollar General would be a good example. They continue their robust location growth. There are other retailers that are adding brick and mortar stores. Just to give our audience a general idea, what are some of the key things when you're evaluating a potential location for a new retail spot to keep in mind in terms of site selection in 2021?
I think the first key item is, where is the competition? And if there is any competition, you know, who are they and how stout are they? And so many times you're looking to plant a new Dollar Tree store that's got to be 2-3 miles away from their nearest good competitor. The other is the density of population. So there's kind of an average that a lot of the regional and bigger retailers look at. They're looking for a minimum of 50 to 75,000 people in a 3-mile radius. So that's another key factor. The education, believe it or not, is a factor, not a major one, but a medium one. Income levels are another. So if you're a discount store, you don't care necessarily that you have a Beverly Hills demographic around you if you're a discounter. However, if you're a little higher end, you're an Ethan Allen, you're going to be looking for the higher income. So it'll just vary depending on what kind of business that retailer actually conducts.
I'm also curious too, because we've heard quite a bit about retrofitting for the purpose of curbside pickup, for the purpose of buy online pickup in store, trying to increase throughput on those fronts. What are some things that you've seen retailers in your work do to kind of keep that in mind in terms of maybe either retrofitting a current location or when you build a new location?
That's very interesting. I have seen a lot of examples of completely redoing just the merchandising floor to wider aisles to keep people apart from each other, which is something we live with today, but also pushing their e-commerce or their home delivery. So some of the big boys like the Walmarts and the Amazons and even the Targets and a number of others are pushing the home delivery. Home Depot has a great concept where they have taken chunks of their parking lot and you go and pick up your phone order. You don't even go into the store. And that's helping them a lot. With the food users, the takeout, and to some degree in California, we're close to maybe 25% seating at a restaurant that's coming up. But up until now, it's been takeout only. So there's a different kind of advertising that goes into pushing a product to people that can't come and sit there. They need to call in or go online and come by and pick up their food. So the Home Depots have pickup. So many of them have pickups like that. But they're also reorienting the middle of their stores in terms of their products. In some cases, Trent, we're seeing that there isn't as much merchandise inside these stores. So that is something. The other is some stores and companies to stay alive are downsizing. So if you have a 12,000, 15,000 square foot, you know, variety store of some kind, furniture and tchotchkes and that sort of thing, you might need to let that go and go into a 5,000 square foot store to stay alive, to reduce your overhead. So some of it is retailers protecting their financial backbone while staying in business because they don't want to go away. So there's some of that. The e-commerce, we didn't expect in the retail real estate world that e-commerce would dissolve in-store and bricks and mortar. But because of the pandemic, e-commerce has soared way beyond what the statistical expectation was of how e-commerce would bite into in-store purchases in the bricks and mortar. And it's become a reality, but so many of the retailers that have never been involved in e-commerce are completely involved in revamping that just to keep sure that they still have another customer to access who's afraid to go out. So a very interesting, completely different evaluation of how things are conducting, and a lot of it unexpected as of February of 2020.
That's certainly the case. You know, you've talked about downsizing in certain circumstances. You've talked about mixed-use developments. From someone that is involved in commercial real estate on a day-to-day basis, what does the next, let's say 5 years of retail real estate look like based on your analysis?
I think nationally, you're always going to have your hotspots that are better than other places where you have more a focused investment and that sort of thing. But I think over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see a metamorphosis in terms of how people are conducting their purchases and how the retailers are addressing those needs. I think it's going to be pretty much a wholesale change with respect to what we find when we go to a grocery store. If I'm an MD and I'm on the third floor of a medical building, it might be better for my patients to come to a shopping center and walk in on the ground floor. So I think the mixed use aspect of real estate is going to occur in a big way. Instead of a completely retail tenanted center, we're going to see what they call mixed use, which will have some medical, some office in it, and the retail. In some of these big centers, when you have these big changes, like, pardon me, for example, last year, Google took over a huge part of a closed mall, the West Side Pavilion in LA, and Google's used as office, but they still need some amenities. So in that Google facility, there's still going to be some retail services, even though that's predominantly turned into office. So I think that the malls are going to change, the shopping centers are going to change, and we all have to adapt with it. Both the retailers and the consumer are all changing. People say, well, Bruce, don't you think it'll change back after the pandemic's over in 2022, 23, everything's back to normal? There's no normal anymore. I think that my prediction is that there'll be a new normal, which looks a lot different than the way we used to conduct retail real estate and investment and finance in the past.
Some great insight there. Once again, Bruce Milton from Lee & Associates. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Trent, my pleasure. Anytime, you be well.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Once again, we thank Bruce for joining us. And our Looking Ahead segment this week, as I mentioned in the open, we're going to talk about REI. And REI, just over the last couple of weeks, has begun releasing their member dividend, or not dividend this year, because they didn't make a profit. That's something that caught me by a little bit of surprise, but their member reward, now they give out this reward, which is typically a dividend at a rate of purchases for their customers. This year, they didn't make a profit, but they're still holding true to giving out the same reward to members. Now, that's not why I'm necessarily looking ahead. I'm looking ahead because some of their financial numbers certainly caught me a little bit off guard. And as I look through, and I'm an REI member, as is Layton actually on the show, we both spend a significant amount of time outdoors. And I think it's interesting that you have an industry where we just talked about it recently with Dick's Sporting Goods and other sporting goods retailers, Hibbett, Big Five. They're seeing a lot of success as people wanting to get outdoors. Now, this is not the case with necessarily all sporting goods retailers or all outdoors retailers. You think of Sierra Trading Company, for example, under the TJX banner. Their comp store sales were down, of course, because a lot of their stores were closed or reduced capacity, and their e-commerce isn't perhaps as mature. TJX's as a whole, as a company, isn't all that mature, but REI's is, and so to see an atmosphere where, again, a lot of people spending money in this category and REI didn't manage to return a profit this year, that really caught me off guard. So I'm looking ahead, put simply, to their annual member meeting. And this is something that they have every year for members. This year, it's on May 3rd, 2021. We may cover it on the podcast if they give any interesting information. We may not, but I think it's intriguing that, again, REI wasn't able to emerge profitable, and we get certainly that a lot of COVID-related costs probably incurred in this particular industry, but at the same time, a lot of other companies that are in this space or in similar spaces were returning a profit during 2020. So I'll be anxious to see if they cover anything specifically on that member call that happens to stick out. And certainly, if they do, we'll relay it here on the podcast. Now, coming up on next week's show, we're at least scheduled to be joined by Jim Johnson, the head of Merchant Solutions at FIS. FIS has a couple of reports. They've got a global payments report as well as a Generation Pay report coming out. And overall, we're going to be looking at the state of retail payments or the state of payments in retail, something that we last talked about on the podcast about 6 months ago. We wanted to revisit it. And there's some interesting numbers in these reports. Certainly, schedules subject to change, but we hope we can catch up with Jim this next week, and we hope to have that interview for you 7 days from now. Until then, everyone have a fantastic week, and we'll be looking forward to the next show.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.